Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Thursday, February 18th. We have one topic on our agenda today. It's an informational meeting. Before we start our meeting, would you please call the roll?
Representative Hernandez?
Absent.
Representative Levy?
Here by audio.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith?
Representative Smith is here by video.
Vice Chair Pham?
Vice Chair Pham is here by phone.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Vice Chair Reschke is here by phone.
Madam Chair Nathanson?
Present by video. Thank you. One item on the agenda, an informational meeting. I'm opening the informational meeting on tax policy through a racial equity lens. Revenue Committee, this is our time to hear a presentation on a topic important to the legislature generally, but in this instance, we're going to hear about how this topic relates to the work that we are involved in throughout the weeks and months of the year. There has been one change in the list of presenters for invited testimony. In place of Daniel Hauser for Oregon Center for Public Policy, we will hear from Juan Carlos Ordonez. Otherwise, the list of presenters is the same. I anticipate it to be the same as what's on the list. We have until 2:45. Mr. Alanak, will you open this for us, please?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think you covered that, set it up pretty well. I think the only thing I would add is that I believe Rep. Pham had a significant role in organizing this, so I think she wanted to make some opening comments.
That's right. I'm ready to invite everybody who's going to be presenting to turn on your microphone at the point when it's your turn to speak. It's better if you leave it off until you speak, just to prevent some extraneous noises and so forth, like my cell phone dinging that you just heard. Remember to turn your camera on when it's your turn to speak. And Representative Khan Pham, will you please open this presentation for us?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And I apologize I can't be on video. I still lack internet, but I'm so excited to be here for this hearing. And on behalf of the BIPOC caucus, we were honored to be invited to convene this informational hearing on Oregon's tax policy through a racial equity lens. In our recently released 2021 legislative agenda, the BIPOC caucus asserted that revenue is a racial justice issue. And as you will see in the speakers that follow, racial discrimination and inequality has not been just an accident, but has been baked into our laws, including our tax laws, from the beginning. And we can't understand the current racial and economic inequality and the disparate outcomes that we're seeing in our state without looking at systems like our revenue system. At the same time, this means that our revenue system is also a powerful tool to close wealth and income disparities and ensure that all Oregonians have opportunities and investments that they need to thrive. Because that's what our revenue system is about. It's about our vision for the kind of state that we want to build. Just like a budget is a moral document, our revenue system is a reflection of our values as a state. So often, we see and we hear that tax policy is incredibly technical and that it's too complicated for ordinary people to understand, so it's better left to the policy wonks. I hope that today's speakers will highlight the ways in which the decisions that we make in the Revenue Committee do have real life and death consequences for Oregon's families and communities. And I hope this is the first of many conversations, and we can continue to offer these kinds of educational opportunities so it's clear to members of the public that revenue meetings are just as relevant to their lives as, say, housing or education, and that we welcome their engagement because we know that their participation in all aspects of our government including tax policy, is how we can get better policies and in a healthier and more just state. And with that, I am delighted to pass it off to our illustrious panel, and we're going to start with Kalpana Krishnamurti from Forward Together Action.
Hello.
Go ahead.
And Vice Chair Pham and Rexy and members of the committee. My name is Kalpana Krishnamurthy, and I work for Forward Together Action. I am having some challenges getting my video to work, so I'm going to go without video today.
The audio is also just a little bit spotty.
Okay.
Actually, that sounded better. That last okay.
Let's see what happens if I keep going.
That sounds good now. Thank you.
Thank you. Forward Together Action is a multi-issue organization, and we work with Black and Indigenous women of color and non-binary people of color for the systems change that we need for all families to thrive. We are clear that race has been baked into our tax policy since the beginning of our state. The first way this really showed up was in regulations around land. The federal government not only incentivized the theft of native lands in our state by white people, it also simultaneously restricted ownership of land by Native, Black, and non-white people of color in the Oregon Territory. The 1850 Donation Land Claim Act allowed only white settlers to claim up to 320 acres of land. Married couples got double the amount, completely free of charge. And so within a decade, white settlers claimed 2.8 million acres of Indigenous people's land and went from a population of 9,000 to a population of 55,000. And if my first slide is available, I wanted to put up one of the first pieces of law for Oregon. The Oregon Territory and early state government continued the process of exclusion and also used racist tax policy as a punishment for Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. For example, in 1858, the Oregon State Constitution was amended to deny free Black Oregonians and mixed race immigrants from owning property. And we can see overt racism in the annual poll tax of $5. And if you go one more slide forward, And one more. There you go. So this is the language of Oregon's poll tax, if we can go back two slides, that would be great. Oregon's poll tax was an annual tax of $5 for each Black, Chinese, Hawaiian, or mixed race person that was enacted by the Oregon legislature in 1862. It's actually one slide back from this, my apologies. Taking a cue from slave states, the sheriff of each county in Oregon could force individuals who could not or did not pay that tax to work on highways in order to pay their debt. So now if we go forward to the next slide. In 1923, the Oregon Alien Land Law banned Chinese and Japanese immigrants from leasing land in Oregon. And this was a direct response to the success of Japanese farmers in Hood River. The alien land law set up the conditions that allowed for the theft of Japanese farms by white Oregonians that happened after World War II, when interned Japanese farmers living in Hood River were denied the right to return to their lands because of outright theft, vandalism, and concerns for their safety. In all, only 40% of Japanese families were able to return to their orchards and farms in Hood River. So these are the three policies in our early territory and statehood about land ownership. And you might be wondering, why am I bringing up policies that are so old and outdated? That's because by putting its weight behind racist policy of denying land ownership to Black, Indigenous, Asian, and other people of color in our states, the legislature was in fact making tax and wealth policy that affected generations of Oregonians. The ability to pass land and property between generations is a significant way that wealth accrues in families, and Oregon meaningfully denied BIPOC families this opportunity for more than 75 years. Beyond land ownership, some of the key policies that have been implemented in Oregon come from policies designed to codify white supremacy in southern states after the Civil War. For example, the first property tax limit was built in Alabama in 1875 as a way to protect white property owners from the possibility that Black Alabamians could be in power and increase property tax rates to fund education and other services. Another tax policy developed by Southern white lawmakers to enforce white supremacy is the supermajority. The original supermajority requirement was built by wealthy white Mississippians as a way to create limits on the kind of investments that the state could make in Black schools and other public services. When Oregon voters passed our supermajority and property tax limits in the 1990s, neither ballot measure talked explicitly about race. However, we can see the same coded arguments about the size of government in the campaign materials that were used by the proponents' measure. Both policies were promoted by anti-tax activists that were intent on limiting the size and scope of government and government services. And the result of these two tax measures are a state starved of resources to address the systemic racism that leads to inequitable outcomes for BIPOC families and communities in our state, and everything from education to healthcare to the criminal justice system. The cut in property taxes that we know we had with ballot measures 5, 47, and 50 also have a disproportionate impact, and that impact is around gentrification.
Excuse me, I think it might be time to progress to the next slide. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you.
Sorry for the interruption.
Thank you. So the impacts of measures 5, 47, and 50, we're all aware of how those ballot measures limited resources for the state of Oregon in terms of revenues. But they also had a second effect, which was advancing gentrification. We all know the history, for example, of redlining in Portland that led banks not to invest or offer loans to Black Oregonians. This really had two results. One, it concentrated Black Portlanders in specific neighborhoods. And two, those Black neighborhoods had lower assessed values on their homes because they were Black neighborhoods. When measures 47 and 50 passed in the 1990s, they collectively disconnected property taxes from a home's real market value and moved to an artificial system of assessed value. The measures also reduced property's assessed values, and finally, they limited property tax growth to 3% annually. And this happened during a time when home values in communities of color were depressed because of the 1990s recession. So when property taxes shifted from real market value to assessed value, some properties got frozen at this depressed level. And that seems like it would be good for residents who live there, right? Well, no, because when wealthier white residents began moving into these areas, displacing long-term Black residents in the process, they not only bought the homes on the cheap, they also locked in low property taxes as a result of these ballot measures. Years later, the real market value of these properties have soared, and yet the assessed value formula keeps gentrifiers' property taxes artificially low, much lower than other properties that sets a similar price. And because Oregon's formula for property tax never resets when a house sells, these low rates from the 90s have gotten locked in over time, dramatically skewing our property tax calculations. Beyond property taxes, our current tax policy continues to benefit white Oregonians, even when race isn't named. And my esteemed colleagues on the panel will be talking about more of those today, from the mortgage interest deduction to the kicker. Our tax policy has to be created and viewed with a lens towards racial equity. Otherwise, the structural racism that's embedded in our economic system around wages, taxes, and wealth ends up widening the gaps between wealthy Oregonians and communities of color. And if we can go to the next slide, there are some proactive steps that Oregon can take to address the race and taxes. So the first one is to close tax loopholes that benefit the wealthiest white Oregonians. The vast majority of tax savings are due to exclusions, deductions, and preferential rates for capital gains that go to the wealthiest 20% of households. Those households are overwhelmingly white. They're nearly 80% of the households in the top economic quintile. The reasons that lower-income families and families of color don't benefit are simple. If a family has limited income and therefore little or no tax liability, its members can't benefit from an itemized tax deduction. The second step we can take is evaluating all tax policy on a progressivity index that includes a specific measure around racial equity. This approach would also guide Oregon to avoid overusing consumption taxes, which disproportionately impact low-income Oregonians. We can start taxing wealth using a progressive approach. What if we applied a higher tax rate to higher value homes? If we identified second homes and vacation homes for higher tax rates? If we considered tracking and taxing stocks, bonds, patents, copyrights, and other forms of private wealth? What if we enhanced taxation on inherited fortunes? We should also address our constitutionally mandated tax policies like the kicker, the supermajority requirements, and property tax limits. In addition to benefiting primarily wealthy white Oregonians, they limit our ability to make the large-scale structural interventions in services that would address the disproportionate impact of race in systems ranging from education to healthcare. Lastly, we could collect better data about race and taxes from Oregonians. A lot of our tax data comes from federal tax information, which doesn't collect race data. We should make a different choice in Oregon and collect as much data as we can about race and taxes in our state. Some places to include starting collecting race data of people filing taxes in our state, ask businesses to name the race of the business owner or the license holder. On a final note, as I wrap up, many of the solutions I've shared and that my panelists will share focus on adjusting our tax policy so that it's more equitable in distributing taxes across income and wealth. In conjunction with tax policies that appropriately tax the wealthiest Oregonians, the legislature should also consider targeted policies that benefit Black, Indigenous, and communities of color. Tax policy that comes from a reparations framework could include individual payments, free college tuition, student loan forgiveness, housing down payment grants, business startup grants, and other racially specific policies that acknowledge the history of structural racism in our state and its ongoing impact on communities of color today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for the presentation. Committee, I would like to make sure that all of the presenters have ample time to present the information, but if any of the committee members has a question right now about this portion of the presentation, maybe it's best to bring it forth now while the slides are still available to us before we move to the next presenter. Did anyone have a question for this section before we move on?
Okay.
Okay, let's take the next presenter, please.
Great, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Mike Leachman. I'm with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and in Washington, D.C. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan research institution. And I really appreciate the chance to talk with you all today and to join in this conversation. If we could advance the slide forward, please. And maybe we could go to the next one after this, please. Thank you. You can go back. Thank you. State and local tax policy really is a powerful structural force in our lives. The decisions that we make have major consequences for the lives of families and for our communities. You know, in this country, we depend on states and localities to deliver many of our national priorities, to educate our children, to keep us healthy, to invest in the infrastructure that that allows our economy to work. And so tax policy decisions, the decisions we make about how much to raise for those investments and how we raise that money, from whom we raise that money, makes a big difference in our lives. State and local tax system, as Kalpana was just describing very effectively, is not race neutral. You know, we raise taxes at the state level primarily from income taxes on individuals and corporations, and at the local level from property taxes. And we don't raise those taxes based directly on people's race, but of course the incomes that people have and the property that they own is very much shaped by historical racism and by ongoing forms of discrimination and bias. So when we make decisions, policy decisions today, there's no way we can avoid the reality that we're either making racial inequities, those historical racial inequities that have been left to us, either better, worse, or leave them the same, which is not acceptable. Next slide, please. Now, because of historical racism and ongoing forms of discrimination and bias, wealth in this country is very unequally distributed. So this just emphasizes the point that I was just making, that tax policy can't be race neutral because of the legacy that we've been left with. So about two-thirds of all wealth in the country is owned by the top 10% of white households. Most of the rest is owned by other white households, with only 13% owned by all other households. Next slide, please. Now, one way to measure whether state and local tax systems are doing their job in pushing back against this legacy that we've been left with is to look at who pays state and local taxes. And at a national level, in 9 out of 10 states, that state and local tax system actually functions to make racial inequities worse. So this looks at the national level, the share of income by quintile that households pay in state and local taxes. And as you can see, it's upside down. Those with the highest incomes pay the least as a share of their income in state and local taxes. And again, that's true in nine out of 10 states. This is both because of the disparities in who holds income and also in the structure of our state and local tax systems. This really is this is what structural racism looks like. Next slide, please. Now, Kalpana mentioned a couple of different examples of ways in of specific tax policies that have their roots in a racist past, property tax limits and supermajority requirements to raise revenue, both having their beginnings in the beginnings of the Jim Crow South in the late 19th century. And some of those policies are still in place. The original policies enacted in those states are still in force today. And clearly they've helped to shape state and local tax systems all across the country. I wanted to just flag one other example, and that is that the increased reliance of states and localities across the country on fees and fines rather than taxes to pay for public services, and particularly courts and police. The slide that I showed just previously, that the upside down state and local tax system across the country, doesn't include fees and fines. So if we did add those, the system would look even more regressive. And particularly in our criminal legal system, we are increasingly using fees on people who get caught up in the system to pay for those courts and police. And often people end up getting locked up simply because they can't afford to pay. Next slide, please. I'm going to skip this slide for time reasons, please. Next slide. I wanted to say a little bit about the federal tax system, which also has been shaped by racism and white supremacy. One good example is that the Constitution requires that any form of direct tax in the language of the Constitution must be apportioned equally across the states based on population. And that part of the Constitution is also the part of the Constitution that included the infamous three-fifths rule that said that people who were being held as slaves only counted as three-fifths of a person. Clearly this part of the Constitution was a result of a compromise with slaveholding states and protected slavery. That provision, that part of the Constitution, was used for many decades to preclude the enactment of a federal income tax. But once the amendment was adopted that allowed for a federal income tax, that was only when we were able to have it. And this part of the Constitution continues to shape policy around about what kind of wealth we might be able to tax. Now, even though clearly that part of the Constitution was built to protect slavery, and we don't have slavery anymore, so it shouldn't. But some argue that that part of the Constitution precludes certain forms of wealth tax. Next slide, please. Now, overall, the federal tax system is progressive. That is, it asks more as a percentage of income from those who have more income, but not as much as it could. And when you include state upside down state and local tax systems, and you look beyond, especially when you look beyond income taxes to payroll taxes and other form of federal tax, that progressivity gets to be much, much less. And the 2017 tax law made things worse. So this is an example of a policy where we're choosing to worsen racial inequities rather than improve them, with more of the benefits of the tax cuts in that law going to the top 1% top 1% of households than the entire bottom 60% of households combined by far. Next slide, please. Also, one thing to consider when looking at the federal tax code is the way in which tax breaks are embedded in the income tax code are skewed very much to the top, and because of the legacy of historical racism and ongoing forms of discrimination bias, that means that it's skewed towards benefiting white households. Most, as you can see in the chart, most of the benefit of the tax code goes to people, to households in the top fifth. Next slide, please. Also, in recent years, the funding for IRS enforcement has declined sharply, and therefore audit rates for high-income filers and large corporations has declined sharply as well, with obvious racial implications. Next slide. Finally, at both the federal and state and local levels, it's important to think about not only how we raise the revenue, but how much are we raising, and are we able to make investments in our families and communities in ways that promote equity and help us to overcome historical racism. At the federal level, we are, compared to other high-income countries, not doing very well in this regard. There are 27 countries that raise more as a share of 27 high-income countries that raise more as a share of GDP than the United States does, with only five countries raising in that group raising less. I'll close in the next slide. Next slide, please. So just in closing, again, tax policy is not race neutral. It cannot be, and the choices that we make at the state level, at the local level, and the federal level can make a big difference. It's up to us to do so. Thanks so much for the chance, and I look forward to hearing from the other presenters.
Thank you, Mr. Leachman. Committee members, I'd like to ask at this time if you have any questions for Mr. Leachman on the slides that we've just seen. And could we go back to the slide just before this? We saw it only for a moment. I'd like to make sure the committee can see the slide. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, I'm not seeing or hearing any. We do have a couple of members on by phone, but I'm not seeing any questions. All right, thank you again, Mr. Leachman. It's time for the next presenter.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes, just fine. Thank you.
Wonderful. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Juan Carlos Ordóñez. I am the communications director for the Oregon Center for Public Policy. And I want to start by echoing the message from the last slide we just saw, that tax policy is not race neutral. Tax policy can either entrench existing racial inequality, or it can help us move forward by reducing racial disparities. And unfortunately, right now here in Oregon, the tax system entrenches economic inequality by race. While there are some positive features in our tax structure, and I'm going to touch on that, and by positive, I mean in the sense that they advance racial equity, we also have many provisions in our tax system that deepen racial inequality. And the same dynamic that exists nationally, an overall regressive state and local tax structure, is also present here in Oregon. Next slide, please. And I apologize, there may be a lag in my video. I'm not sure if you're seeing the next slide yet. No, please go back one. So thank you. So here's the Oregon version of the chart that you saw earlier. This ad shows us the overall tax structure here in Oregon, the combination of state and local taxes. And when you add up all the taxes levied at the state and local level here in Oregon, what you end up is with an upside down tax structure, one that asks proportionally more of lower income Oregonians than of higher income Oregonians. So specifically, the bottom earning fifth of Oregonians pay about 12.8% of their total income in state and local taxes. And no other group here in Oregon pays more. By contrast, the average member of the top 1% pays about 8.2% in state and local taxes. And no other group pays less. So this tax structure that we see here violates a basic principle of tax fairness, the idea that taxes should be based on ability to pay, that the tax system should ask proportionally more of the rich than of the poor. It's also key to understand that this is a tax structure that not only entrenches, but even exacerbates inequality by race. We've already heard from Kalpana and Mike about some of the history of discrimination and exclusion, both in Oregon and nationally. And certainly as a result of the past and present forms of discrimination and racial exclusion, Oregonians of color endure greater economic challenges that manifest themselves in higher rates of poverty, lower incomes, lower rates of homeownership, and much lower levels of wealth. And next slide, please. Next slide, please. When you take this economic reality and layer it on top of a regressive tax structure, it's no surprise that to find that the tax system exacerbates racial inequities. I'm sorry, please go back one. I think you skipped one.
Excuse me, Mr. Ordonez, while we're moving between slides, Representative Marsh has a question.
Oh, sure, yeah, happy.
Thank you. This was actually a question on the slide prior to this. The second 10%, there was a little blip, and I'm just curious whether that's just a statistical anomaly or whether there's some explanation as to why the middle 20, that 11% is out of sequence with everything else that declines.
I'm not seeing that. But yes, there's a slight blip. I would have to get back to you on the specifics as to why they are lower. It may have to do with the impact of the earned income tax credit, perhaps. But the specific reasons, I will need to get back to you on that, and I'll make a note to
yeah, that'd be great. I'm interested to whether there's something structural there. Mm-hmm. That is pushes that middle 20.
Okay, thank you. So moving on to the next slide. I'm not sure if there's a lag in my video, but the next slide basically makes the point that before taxes, white Oregonians start off with significantly higher average income, in fact, 27.8% higher than the rest of the state. And when you throw taxes into the mix, that disparity actually increases. It increases to 28.1%. And we know that much of the regressivity of Oregon's tax structure, what we see, we're still seeing the upside down tax structure here. Much of the regressivity stems from excise taxes and property taxes, which fall more heavily on those with lower incomes. But it is also due to the many tax expenditures that blunt the progressivity of Oregon's personal income tax. If we could move two slides, the one regarding the So yeah, this is the one. Yeah. So Oregon's tax code. No, I'm sorry. Go back one, please. Oregon's tax code has many tax expenditures that deliver the most benefits, that deliver most of the benefits to the most well-off, those who are less likely to be Oregonians of color. And the mortgage interest deduction is really a glaring example of this. The mortgage interest deduction is projected to cost Oregon about $1.1 billion in the upcoming budget period, making it one of the largest tax expenditures on the books. And it is also Oregon's biggest housing program. I mean, nothing else, no other housing program in Oregon comes even close to the cost of the mortgage interest deduction. Nothing comes close to the billion-dollar price tag of this tax subsidy. And the mortgage interest deduction exacerbates inequality in two ways. If you could show the next slide, please. First, like deductions generally, the mortgage interest deduction delivers most of its benefits to those higher up the income ladder. And so we can see that still in this slide. Most of the benefits are flowing to those at the top of the income ladder. Because Oregonians tend to have significantly lower incomes than white Oregonians, they are less likely to benefit from the mortgage interest deduction. But more inequitably still, by definition, you cannot benefit from the mortgage interest deduction unless you own a home. It is a subsidy for homeowners. And if you rent, the mortgage interest deduction is of no use. Now, Black Oregonians, Latinos, Native Americans have much lower levels of homeownership compared to white Oregonians. And this did not happen by accident. Kalpana already touched on some of the reasons for this, but certainly racist policies at both the state, federal, and local level starting in the 1930s and spanning over many decades subsidized and nurtured homeownership amongst white Americans while denying people of color the same benefits. And this slide here illustrates one of those specific policies. It shows the redlining of neighborhoods in Oregon, neighborhoods where Black Oregonians lived. And as a result of policies such as redlining and many other discriminatory policies and practices, both past and present, we have arrived at the current reality where where BIPOC communities are much less likely to own a home than white Oregonians. And as a subsidy for homeowners, the mortgage interest deduction entrenches this highly inequitable state of affairs. At this very moment, the inequity of the mortgage interest deduction couldn't be more jarring. We're gonna be spending $1 billion subsidizing mostly well-off homeowners, while tens of thousands of families that rent, disproportionately families of color, are facing the risk of eviction as a result of the pandemic. Another example of inequitable—
Excuse me, Mr. Ordonez, I'm not seeing a legend on this slide so that I know what the different colors represent. And I love the idea of using a picture. It's worth 1,000 words. But could you explain to us what each of those colors is representing, since I can't see a legend?
Chair Nathan said, I will have to get back to you on the other colors other than the red, because I don't recall them off the top of my head. But the red portions are the red line sections, and that's where the term redlining comes from, because they were actually marked in the color red. I will be happy to get back to the committee on the specific what the other colors represented.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Another example that I want to cite regarding inequitable tax expenditures: in 2013, the Oregon legislature created a set of lower tax rates for pass-through businesses that meet certain conditions. And these preferential tax rates are also highly inequitable. If we could turn to the next slide. Great, thank you. Nearly all of the tax benefits from the lower preferential tax rates for pass-through businesses flow to the very highest earning Oregonians, who are also disproportionately white. More than two-thirds of the benefits from this tax expenditure goes to Oregonians making over $500,000 a year. And this highly skewed distribution already signals that this tax expenditure disproportionately benefits white Oregonians. But in addition to that, because people of color face greater barriers when it comes to starting or expanding a business, business owners are disproportionately white. Here in Oregon, data from before the pandemic showed that about 90% of businesses in Oregon were owned by white Oregonians, even though they make white Oregonians make up about 75% of the state's population. So eliminating or reforming regressive tax expenditures, such as preferential tax rates for pass-through businesses and the mortgage interest deduction, would be good for the vast majority of Oregonians, Black, brown, and white. I mean, it's important to remember that most low-income Oregonians are white, and they too bear the brunt of an upside-down tax system. At the same time, eliminating or reforming regressive tax expenditures would help Oregon make progress on reducing racial disparities. Next slide, please. So I would like to just to finish on a positive note, it's worth mentioning the Oregon's estate tax. We know that as it has been mentioned before, wealth is highly concentrated amongst white families, white Oregonians, as a result of a whole history of public policies and practices. Oregon's estate tax is a policy that helps correct this inequity. It is one of the more equitable features of our tax code. In 2017, only the wealthiest percent of Oregonians who died that year had estates impacted by Oregon's estate tax. And the estate tax helps fund schools and other essential services that benefit all Oregonians. Regrettably, most legislative sessions, we see calls to weaken Oregon's estate tax. And this session is no exception to that. So we would urge this committee to reject such calls, and we would certainly encourage you to keep in place a strong estate tax. In conclusion, our current regressive tax structure entrenches and even deepens racial inequities. Making our tax structure more progressive not only would benefit the vast majority of Oregonians, Black, brown, and white, but it would also help our state make progress in reducing racial inequities. Thank you very much, and if there's any other questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you, committee. Anyone want to ask a question at this point? Yes, I see. Representative Levy, please.
Thank you, Juan, very much for the presentation. I appreciate it. Where did you get your population data to tell us how it was skewed? Because I believe that we have more Hispanics in our state than ever before, and they are probably more Hispanics in our state than there are whites or any other person of any color right now.
Can I ask if I understood the question correctly? Are you saying that that Hispanics are Latinos are the biggest share of Oregon's population?
I believe that if they're not now, they certainly will be really soon, because they're in my county where I live, there are very close to being more Latinos in our county than there are people of any other color.
Representative Livy, thank you for the question. The data that we use comes from the ACS. All the evidence that certainly we've seen in the data, white Oregonians remain the largest share of Oregon's population, non-Hispanic white, I should say. It's about 3/4 of the population. Certainly the Latino population in Oregon has been growing at a fairly good clip, but it still remains a minority for sure. It's certainly the case that in some areas of Oregon, Latinos may constitute a greater share than other groups, but certainly with regards to the state as a whole, white Oregonians remain a significant majority.
Chair Nathanson, may I make another comment?
Certainly.
Okay, thank you, Juan. I appreciate that. Then, so in my community, for example, Hermiston and the surrounding areas, our community has opened up their arms for Hispanic businesses, and we have a lot of Asians in our community from Vietnam and from we have a group from Seoul, and we've had the most amazing food places that they have all opened, and their culture has become very ingrained in our communities. But I believe that's because we have opened up our arms and our hearts to having them be successful. Do you find that in the larger communities, because we live in a small community, 18,000 people, Echo, where I actually live, has only got 635 people. Do you think that the smaller communities are more welcoming than the larger communities? Do you find that in the research that you've done?
Representative Levy, thank you for the question. I have not specifically looked into that question as to the regional differences or whether small communities are more welcoming than others. I mean, I can't say that with regards to the state as a whole, communities of color do face greater barriers to establishing businesses. And one of the big factors for that is simply the access to capital. Because as you know, if you think about the fact that families of color tend to have a lot less wealth. In fact, many families of color have negative wealth. It's a problem for Oregon families as a whole, but certainly a disproportionate problem for BIPOC communities. The fact of having negative wealth. So without that access to capital, it just becomes much harder to begin a business. That certainly it's great to hear that in some communities. Like yours, there is a flourishing of businesses owned by Oregonians of color. But on the whole, the numbers for Oregon show that white Oregonians disproportionately own the businesses in the state, and certainly the biggest businesses. That also bears mentioning.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Alanak, I would like to ask you on the subject of demographic information that's available to us. I believe when we have information presented, for example, from the Office of Economic Analysis maybe from other places, they're probably using population data from the research done at Portland State University. Could you describe where data comes from that is sometimes used by the Revenue Committee? And could you please share with the committee at a future date, you know, just send it to us by email or add it to a presentation somewhere where we can look at that demographic information by county?
Yes, Madam Chair. At Portland State University, the Population Research Center is one of the primary sources used within, like for OEA, for the Democrat and their demographer, and for forecasting and relying on population estimates. And I can get you a link and send a committee a link to that information. I'd have to check it and refresh my memory as to what kind of detail it provides beyond city, county, and state numbers. I can't recall off the top of my head to what extent they dive into some of the racial diversity pieces that are being discussed today. But I can get into that information and send the committee a link.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions for this part of the presentation before we move to the next speaker? Okay, thank you again. We're
thank
ready
you.
For the next.
All right, can folks hear me?
Yep.
Great. Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke. For the record, my name is Matt Newell Ching, and I'm the Public Policy Manager at Oregon Food Bank. Oregon Food Bank's mission is to end hunger and its root causes. And we do that in two primary ways. One is what we're most known for, which is we provide and source food to 20 regional food banks across the state of Oregon, which in turn provides food to 1,400 agencies in every corner of Oregon so that we can support our neighbors to ensure that families have enough to eat, food on the table. We also engage in system change work, so through community organizing, through listening, through ensuring that we're centering the voices of people with lived experience of hunger, building solutions that will address the root causes of hunger. And the reality right now for our communities is pretty stark. Prior to the pandemic, one in 11 families in Oregon experienced hunger. In 2020, one in four families faced hunger, faced food insecurity because of the economic impacts of the pandemic. So our communities, we know, are in crisis. You know, as the public health and economic impacts of the pandemic have fallen hardest on people who have faced systemic inequities for generations. That's communities of color, immigrants and refugees, single parents and caregivers, and our trans and gender non-conforming neighbors. And so I'm grateful for the groundwork that's been done by other presenters, you know, on this panel. I would just say as an opening frame that as we think about emerging stronger, what it means to emerge stronger after this pandemic, it's not enough simply to go back to normal. We need to, because normal just simply was not working for too many people. We look forward to engaging this committee and the legislature in building solutions for our communities so that we can truly emerge stronger after this pandemic is over. And next slide, please. So at Oregon Food Bank, we recognize that systemic injustices exist, such as racism, classism, sexism, and that these create and perpetuate conditions that sustain poverty and hunger. So our food programs and public policy efforts aim to build a society where everyone can thrive, celebrating our differences and working together to overcome injustices that might divide us. There's an adage that every system is perfectly designed to get the results it gets. And this is data taken from the Oregon Hunger Task Force, commissioned by Oregon State University, done by Oregon State University, I should say. And it lays bare the inequities when we look at food insecurity and hunger. And this is prior to the pandemic. And I note that because we know that food insecurity doubled in 2020. And so we do not have, while we don't have food insecurity data that is disaggregated by race specific to Oregon just yet, I'll just say that these disparities were built on for the reasons that prior presenters have highlighted today. But these disparities existed prior to the pandemic and have been heightened by the pandemic. We can go ahead to the next slide. So today I do have the good fortune, we've heard from presenters about ways in which the tax code can solidify existing inequities. And I want to talk about one important tool of public policy and of tax policy that can and has been demonstrated over decades to create more equitable outcomes for our families. And that's the earned income tax credit. And I'm just going to be talking a little bit about how that works. I know over the past years, I've talked with many of you directly about the earned income tax credit and the benefits to families. And so I want to just do a quick overview of how the EITC works for families in our communities and how it addresses inequities, and also just a little bit about how ways that we believe we can improve the EITC so that it can become even more equitable. So this graph that's in front of you, and credit to Mike Leachman and the team at Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, I personally think this is tax policy's most beautiful trapezoid. And what I mean by that is that it demonstrates how the EITC works for families. And so the y-axis is the amount of a credit that a family is eligible for, and the x-axis is a family's income. And so if you actually go to the Center on Budgets website, you can play around and say, okay, what would the ITC be? What would the amount of the credit be for families, depending on how many kids you have, whether you're married, filing joint, or single? And you plop in your earnings and you figure out, okay, you know, what would the credit be? So the example that we're using here in this graph is a full-time minimum wage worker in rural Oregon, where the minimum wage is currently $11.50 per hour, married with two kids. And so that annual salary ends up being $23,920, which is below the federal poverty line. And I just frankly don't know too many communities in which you can raise a family of four at that level, and yet many families are finding and surviving doing just that. So when you file your taxes at the federal level, the earned income tax credit acts as it's almost like a negative income tax for many filers, the EITC has had broad bipartisan support over many decades. And so in this example right here, where this worker and this family would report, you know, $23,900 in earnings, their federal EITC credit would be $5,828. And what you can see in how this how the chart works is that starting at zero, for every dollar you earn, the credit grows, and then it plateaus, and then it slowly slopes down. And I know there's been a lot of good efforts done by this body and others to be intentional about ensuring that public benefits and tax policies don't create benefit cliffs. This is the EITC is structured in a way where there is no cliff. It's a perfect slope. So for every dollar you earn, a family is better off. There's no disincentive to earn that extra dollar. So in this case, the $5,800 credit would take a family from below the federal poverty line to above the federal poverty line, just barely. And on top of that, Oregon matches the federal credit at 9% for most families, and it matches it at 12% for families with kids under the age of three. And so that would work out to about $525 or $699, depending on that family's situation. So that takes the family's earnings to a little over $30,000 a year. Again, not that's still very difficult to live on in Oregon, even with additional public benefit support. That's still very tough to make rent. It's still tough to keep a car, or if you have a car repair that you need. And this goes to examples of when families get credits. Some of the most commonly cited things that families spend the credit on are purchasing or repairing a car, so that families have reliable transportation to get to work safely, to take classes at community college. Sometimes it can be used for first month's or last month's deposit for rent. We should also say that because the credit is tilted, goes to low and moderate income families, that's money that has a significant multiplier effect throughout our economy. And so because families spend that money on goods and services, most of the time in communities, that helps everyone in the community. And so that's the basic structure of the earned income tax credit. So
do we have a frozen audio or video connection?
That addresses racial disparities. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Rep. Nathanson, can you hear me?
We lost you for a minute.
Can anyone hear me?
I can hear you.
Uh-oh. Can anyone hear me?
Yes, we can hear you in the committee room. Mm-hmm. for anyone listening right now, I believe what's happening is that staff are asking him to log back in.
I am logged in. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay. I can now. Sorry.
Everything's okay. It's all good. Okay.
All right. Apologies there. All right. Could I ask to go to the next slide, please? All right. So while the earned income tax credit does, you know, I mean, doesn't call out in the tax code, like, you know, that it's going to that, you know, like different rates for people, you know, that's disaggregated by race or anything like that, because households with lower incomes are disproportionately, BIPOC. It does through, you know, this idea of targeted universalism, where it applies to everyone, but we also affirmatively address a disparity within that. So the credit does disproportionately, in a good way, impact and help reduce inequities in terms of income disparities. 300,000 Oregons live in households that claim the AITC. And we've got over 40 years of research now about the earned income tax credit. And when we talk about, like, what's our return on investment? What kind of outcomes are we seeing because the earned income tax credit exists? And the data is so strong. We see better school performance among kids. We see a higher college enrollment for students when they graduate high school, and we see increased work participation and earnings into adulthood. And so, in addition to the immediate multiplier effect that it has within communities, it's a great long-term investment in kids, just purely from an outcomes-based, and let alone the good that it does for if you are a child in a household that claims EITC. I know this body has talked a lot about the impact of toxic stress that is on household that's related to income, and that is in many ways immeasurable. But the credit really can ease that pressure for families. Most American families don't have $400 in savings. This credit is a critical lifeline to help get families through and purchase the things that they need to purchase. And you can go ahead to next slide. All of that is the very, very good news in the EITC, and I think as an advocate, we're always like, this is good, and there are things that we can do to improve, the EITC. And so, the EITC, for example, if for families that don't have dependents, if for families that don't claim kids in their taxes, the EITC is very small, and we think it could be expanded there. Some older caretakers are excluded. So, for example, families above the age of 64, or if you're a working grandparent and raising a kid, if you're over the age of 64, then you're ineligible for the EITC. Another category, are people who engage in uncompensated care. And we know from the pandemic that this has hit women, and particularly women of color, very, very hard, where women have had to leave the workforce at very disproportionate rates, and women of color as well. And that's had a significant impact on our families and our communities. And since you do have to report income, with the earned income tax credit, there are families that are doing a ton of work. But that work is uncompensated because it's care work for families, and so there's that disparity that the EITC does not address specifically. And finally, tax filers who file with individual taxpayer identification numbers, so these are many immigrant families, including mixed status families, are ineligible for the credit, and that includes if only one member of the household files with an ITIN number, it disqualifies the entire family. And that's different than, like, the child tax credit, for example, where kids who have social security numbers are eligible for the child tax credit. That's something that we're going to reduce. I'm hoping that in the future there's a House Bill 2819, and it won't go into the details there, but that's a bill that would look to address that disparity there. Thank you so much for your time. I'm very grateful for the committee, for your leadership, Rep. Nathanson, Rep. Pham, for bringing this, for highlighting this topic, because I think it's critical that we think about all the tools of public policy that we have to address disparities. And the tax code can be a very powerful tool for addressing racial inequities. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for the presentation. Committee members, any questions before we move to the next speaker? I'll wait just a few seconds in case someone's trying to unmute their phone or raise a hand. Okay, I don't see any. Thank you. We'll move to the next speaker now.
Good afternoon. Can you all hear me well?
I can hear you.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm going to try to get this done before I have a visitor coming and you might hear a lot of dogs barking. So I'm going to try to make sure I get through this as quickly as possible. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you all today. My name is Matt Bartolotti, for the record. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer and Deputy CEO for Metropolitan Family Service. And before I get started, I just want to say, as a white male of privilege, I'm grateful for the opportunity to lend my voice to this conversation, calling out the presence of structural racism in our and my obligation to help disrupt that. I just really appreciate that opportunity, and it certainly helps me become a better ancestor for those that come after me. But from an organizational perspective, I'm grateful because at Metropolitan Family Service, is a culturally responsive organization, we strive to be anti-racist, and we think that means many things, one of which is the system that we live in, and by the human service system and the social service sector is both liberating and oppressive at the same time. And we need to do whatever we can on our own scale to help disrupt that. And so as a multi-service agency, we provide services to about 25,000 people across early learning, K-12, hunger relief, intergenerational supports, and economic justice. Next slide, please. So what I wanted to talk a little bit today is some of the work that we do in our free tax preparation services and some of the work that we do in our economic empowerment services as it relates to access to the earned income tax credit, hopefully building off or kind of burrowing it a little bit to some of the information that Matt just shared. We provide a broad range of economic empowerment services, which are asset-based, asset building services, credit repair, financial counseling, low interest auto loans, individual development accounts, and also we run an IRS certified free tax preparation service called MFS Cash Oregon, formerly Cash Oregon. Next slide, please. So before I get into this, what this slide means, I just wanted to go to illustrate the beautiful trapezoid that Matt just mentioned with a real life, I think, extremely beautiful example. And again, this is kind of that question of the system that we have can both be liberating and oppressive at the same time. So this is someone that just came through our services at MFS Cash Oregon. Rosa, head of household, 3 children. Adjusted gross income of $15,511. She received a federal refund of $9,400, an Oregon refund of $1,576, and an additional $4,500 in stimulus payments. So this nearly doubles the income of Rosa for the year, and it's an important financial resource for her and the community. And most of our taxpayers don't have this large of a refund, but I think it really highlights exactly what Matt said about that beautiful trapezoid, that for some people it can be a transformational point in time to help them build prosperity on whatever scale and direction that they can at that time. So going back to the slide, this represents EITC non-access rates for the fiscal years that we had data. And this information is for individuals for whom we had enough demographic information and enough income information to make this determination. And of course, we're not a research organization. We're a social service provider that tries to collect data in the most rigorous way possible. And as my colleague Kalpana said in the beginning, there really is a dearth of data in any kind of information to really understand access and barriers. So this is kind of the best we could do as a social service agency But what it illustrates here is that around 40% and 43% of the individuals that were eligible for EITC in our service footprint for whom we had relevant data didn't access EITC that should. Next slide. And so this is our attempt to understand that information disaggregated by race. And again, this is the percent of people that should have accessed it that didn't. And so what this shows us here is there's a disproportionate access rate, a lower access rate for BIPOC individuals or more people that were eligible who were BIPOC didn't claim the EITC that should. And it also shows an increase in the number of individuals from Latino Hispanic backgrounds that were eligible for the EITC that didn't claim it. Again, this is information kind of in our own data set, subject to our own, you know, limitations as a social service agency. But this clearly illustrates to us that there's a disparity in access. And more importantly, one of the things that this illustrated to us is that when you look at the average number of people in our social service footprint that didn't access the EITC each year, it's something like 580 people, that translates into something like $1.3 million left on the table among the people in our service footprint alone. And we speculated just, what is that like for all the social service agencies across the state of Oregon? And what could we do if we assessed and addressed this issue alongside all the other social services that are being taken care of among all the different organizations across Oregon? Next slide. And so I wanted to kind of close a little bit by saying kind of what we're doing now at MFS Cache Oregon. That's the part of MFS that provides the free tax preparation services to low-income individuals. And we, as you can see there, I'm calling out the EITC numbers in the Tri-County area. We helped bring about $3 million to families, about 4,000 tax filers. About that use cash are from the BIPOC community. And what I don't have that we help about 18,000 low income taxpayers, 21 million in the Tri-County area annually. And so I just wanted to kind of illustrate the footprint or scope and scale of what we've been able to achieve locally. And then I just wanted to point out in terms of the environment, we all know that the pandemic has exacerbated inequalities and really shined a light on all the areas where disparities have been persistent or areas where we've ignored those disparities. And access to the free tax clinics and free tax preparation services, no exception. We've had to kind of retool everything, move it online, and provide access through free file services. And all of this is predicated on ability to access. So you're talking about technology, you're talking about internet access, all of which disproportionately affect communities of color. And the other thing I wanted to highlight is most of the volunteer workforce that was in effect before the pandemic were older adults. And so we've had to, the workforce itself has been diminished. The places where taxes have been provided, libraries, schools, community centers, all are still closed. And many tax filers are having difficulty accessing this free service. And just to illustrate that point, we opened up January 20th, as you can see on this flyer, and we've received 4,000 calls already and have completed 500 tax returns. And we're able to receive calls from all around the state because of the way that we retool serve in the beginning of the pandemic. So I just wanted to say in closing that the type of work that we're doing and the partnerships that we've been fostering and think need to foster can be scaled across the state, culturally specific, culturally responsive organizations that know how to navigate people to is something that we think is really important and should be paid attention to as we get into the COVID response and recovery period. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Committee, any questions or comments? I'd like to add one here. Mr. Bartolotti, you and Mr. Newell-Ching and I and a few others worked mightily last year.
That's right.
To increase awareness of the EITC as well as applying for federal stimulus payments. But we worked mightily about this. You mentioned something. You were talking about this is about ability to access. In a way, though, that does make the assumption that people want to access this. And one of the barriers that I still am terribly concerned about is so many people figure, I don't owe taxes. I'm not going to file. What's the point? I don't need to. It's a useless activity and it's hard. I can't figure it out. And since I don't owe it, you know, why should I bother? So that's one of the things I think we still need to work on. The work your organization and AARP's Tax Aid and others are doing is fantastic. When I look at the last slide, get your taxes done for free, that's great. I'd also like a campaign to convince people why they ought to file a tax form, because they have money coming back if they would just go through the several minutes. I imagine it's more than just several minutes, but if they would take a little bit of time. So I'd like to come up with something that's a precursor to that. To convince people why they should even care. And then they'll end up visiting you. Mr. Alanak, I would like to ask you about what can you tell us about other additional sources of information on the utilization rate? How much of this is left on the table in Oregon? And then what that costs the Oregon economy, since we don't have that federal money coming into Oregon that is then spent on paying rent or buying some supplies for a student or, you know, whatever it is that the family is choosing to spend the money on, that money is circulating in Oregon. So what can you tell us about the loss to Oregon when we don't have the federal money coming in?
One of the most recent sources of estimates regarding that issue actually comes from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. And I can't recall exactly how recent it is. Maybe somebody, maybe Juan Carlos can recall that. But they put together some estimates of a lack of utilization, kind of the money that's left on the table. It's by people not filing and not claiming their federal and Oregon credit. It might have been more than $100 million. I can't recall exactly. I'd have to dig up the document and send it to you. But by not filing and not claiming it, those are federal dollars that don't come into Oregon. And so the opportunity cost there is fairly significant. We know from other research that lower income households spend more of their money locally than higher income households. So the federal dollars that don't come in is a lost opportunity. And depending on the research over the years, I've seen estimates that the multiplier effect, so for every dollar that would enter the local economy through the federal EIC, the multiplier effect might be $1.5 or maybe even $2. And I've seen some estimates that suggest it might even be a little bit above $2, basically above a 2-to-1 ratio. So that highlights some of the importance of the issue that you're discussing today.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I sit on the board of Oregon Saves, which is the state's retirement program, which has, by its very nature, is applied to people who don't otherwise have access to a retirement program, and as such has a lot of working people in that. And I continue to think that we should be able to knit these programs together in terms of financial education. If you have a regular way of communicating with people through Oregon Saves, then we should be able to communicate around the EI, the tax credit, the earned income tax credit opportunity, the college savings plan. And out of that, I just wanted to note that the treasurer has started a financial education advisory team. And I am not sure what all topics they're taking up, but I'd suggest that as we kind of explore these questions of tax benefits and how we communicate around them, it would be really interesting to have somebody from the treasurer's office come and explain what they are doing and what the intersection of our work with their work might be.
I have a hand raised by one of our presenters. Mr. Ordonez, did you have some comments? And I'll wait just another few seconds to see if there is some response. Might be that someone's on mute and needs to unmute.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can now, yes. And
yes,
then
apologies for that. I just wanted to follow up on the question of how much Oregon is leaving on the table. We looked at this question looking at the data from 2016, and that's the most recent data that we have. And we estimated that Oregon left on the table $127 million federal dollars as a result of the underutilization of the EITC. In addition to that, Oregon workers lost out on those $127 million federal dollars, as well as an additional $10 million from the Oregon EITC. So hopefully that addresses the question.
Thank you very much for that response. Mr. Bartolotti, if you have a closing reaction, that's fine. And then we'll move to our next presenter. And I think we'll be done about on time at a quarter till. Mr. Bartolotti.
Thank you. Yes, quick closing. Thank you again, Rep. Nathanson, for last year's effort, support, and leadership. And then just the closing comment on awareness. We've been working on the notion of tax navigation, which is partnering with culturally specific and responsive organizations that have an interest in this area. They can integrate an assessment of an individual's tax awareness in their own intake process, and then successfully connect them to a person or an organization that provides that expert level of free tax preparation. So that's kind of the vital knit, I think, exactly what you're talking about, that we're definitely interested in. We've developed some ideas on that and working with some partners. So we'd love to share those at some point whenever it makes sense. So thank you so much.
And thank you as well. Let's have the final speaker.
All right, good afternoon, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, Vice Chair Reschke, and members of the committee. My name is Jenny Lee, and I'm the Deputy Director at the Coalition of Communities of Color, and we're a coalition of culturally specific organizations dedicated to taking collective action for racial justice. Good news, I only have one slide, so if you want to advance to the next one, but I'm very grateful to be here today, and I hope to draw something of a through line to how the inequities that you have heard about lead to disinvestments that result in disparate outcomes for Black, Indigenous, and other Oregonians of color. Equity in revenue and equity in investments are two sides of the same coin. We've heard about the history of our current PAC structure, many of the examples, and some of the specific solutions that we can implement. And I'd like to take this time to look at the other side of the coin and how racism in our revenue structure leads to inequitable outcomes for BIPOC Oregonians when it comes time to build our budget. Currently structured, our tax system essentially enables wealth to lead more wealth. This is incredibly important because of how it entrenches racial disparities into our society. An equitable revenue structure should be designed to create shared prosperity rather than deepening inequality. For example, intergenerational wealth transfers are not limited to the examples we often hear about, so concrete inheritances of homes or cash, but it also includes a parent's ability to afford high-quality preschool or a grandparent's ability to put money into a tax-advantaged college savings plan. Or it's when a worker is able to save enough for retirement so that their adult children don't have to take on the financial responsibility for their care, and that leaves them to save more for their own children. These investments, these systems that we've built, provide a lifetime of benefits for some and a lifetime of inequities for others, inequities that fall along racial lines. As advocates and as legislators, we've had many opportunities to work together to make investments in areas like early learning or homeownership assistance. These are critical supports, but because we always have an insufficient allocation of resources, they end up as scattershot solutions that are available to a fraction of those who don't have the income or wealth to access these resources otherwise. And the reason that many BIPOC, immigrant, and refugee communities have long been shut out of opportunity is, frankly, based on their race. Small interventions for just a few of those in need will not be enough to close the racial wealth gap or create equitable health outcomes. We need to shift these systems through real investments. For example, investing in our children requires not just investing in quality K-12 education, but ensuring that they and their families have food, housing, and health care. And for our state to prosper, every Oregonian needs those basics. It's also important to note that just as an ideology of racial privilege was built into our revenue structure, it has also driven disinvestment in public resources. There are many variations on the stereotype that some people are productive taxpayers, which has been coded racial language, and others, meaning people of color, often Black folks and immigrants, take advantage of what are really public goods. For a number of reasons, this is patently untrue, but across the country, as communities diversified, this ideology took hold and resulted in funding cuts to public infrastructure that had enabled many white families to enter the middle class. Here in Oregon, we must be vigilant in understanding and redressing this phenomenon. Now, looking to our current moment, collectively, Oregonians of color have repeatedly raised their voices, pointing out that the deep disparities during COVID, both the virus itself and the attendant economic fallout, have laid bare the structural racism in our society. We saw what happens when service sector jobs are lost en masse and basic resources such as food assistance or unemployment insurance aren't readily accessible. We've seen how social determinants of health resulted in deadly COVID disparities for Oregonians of color. And the lack of equitable investments that had been compounding for decades left many Oregonians with little insulation against the force of this crisis. At the same time, folks with higher incomes in many ways were left somewhat untouched. And then when the government didn't meet the need for those who were struggling the most, many culturally specific organizations, community members of color mobilized to provide aid for those in their community who had always been denied equal access to economic resources. So speaking about my work over the past year, when I was working to help distribute just simple gift cards at the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, we would receive heartbreaking notes of gratitude from community gift members for gift cards. We're worth as little as $25 or $50. And we all saw the stories how tens of thousands of residents would attempt to seek government assistance allocated by state and local governments, but the money would run out in days or even hours. And when this hardship becomes so undeniably visible, I think that tells us something really important, that many of these Oregonians, parents, workers, caregivers, had the ingenuity and the commitment to cobble resources together and just barely make ends meet, but provide for their families. But however, because there's not ever been a real way to save for a rainy day, let alone an unprecedented crisis, that is how the economic, the impacts have been so severe, particularly on our Oregonians of color. At the same time, the emergencies of COVID and influx of federal resources enabled us to start making some of the economic investments that we've already always needed, whether that was something like internet access to a new Chromebook or a fund for unemployed workers who aren't otherwise eligible for public assistance. COVID moved the Oregon State Legislature to begin grappling with these inequities and squarely address racial injustice through programs like the Oregon Cares Fund and Worker Relief Fund. These programs represent the best of Oregon's values of inclusion and reflect them and put them into action in our budget. We also know that we need to go further, and that requires changing our tax policy. While the federal government may have contributed the lion's share of relief dollars, as the state rebuilds, we must fund the services and programs that will be needed long-term to create prosperity. Our revenue structure and our state budget right now, in some ways, are working at cross purposes, privileging wealth and high income on one side on our revenue structure, and then using our budget to try and address the racial inequities. And that means that the math simply won't add up. Without the revenue that we could readily access by changing our tax policies, we can't make the investments we need. Community members and advocates have come time and time again to the legislature asking, pleading for small investments that would downright transform individuals' lives. They get denied on the basis we can't afford that investment, and that's even in good economic times. And these responses are not acceptable so long as we have tax policies on the books that benefit the wealthiest. And as I close, a final note just to remind us that while we're discussing here how the intersections of these systems impact or communities of color, as Juan Carlos noted earlier, an equitable revenue system and investments will benefit every Oregonian, either Black, brown, or white, and create more inclusive communities. So we've inherited a system shaped by racism, but it is within our collective power to change. This hearing is a very meaningful step in the process of acknowledging how Oregonians of color are impacted by our tax structure. And I am grateful for all of you taking the time to have us here today. I hope that you will engage with our communities to pursue the recommendations, such as those shared by our earlier speakers, and take full advantage of your role as leaders to champion the investments we need for BIPOC Oregonians to thrive. Thank you again for this opportunity, and we look forward to working with you as our state works to dismantle our racist legacies and rebuild a better Oregon for all of us.
Thank you for your presentation. Do you have any questions or comments for this speaker? Again, I'll wait just a few seconds in case someone's trying to get the technology working. Thank you, all of you, for the presentations, the slides, the notes, your presentations that you gave to us in person. I learned a lot. I just can't say enough about the quality of information you've presented us with. And Representative Pham, thank you so much for organizing this for us. Would you like to close it for us?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Yes, I also want to express my deep gratitude to the presenters for this incredibly educational panel. I hope this is just the beginning of an ongoing conversation on racial equity and tax policy. This has given the Revenue Committee much to ponder and reflect on, and I hope it can inspire us on this committee to work together to ensure that we have a revenue system that builds a positive foundation for all Oregonians. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is Representative Rusky. Can I make a quick comment?
Of course.
Hello. So again, yeah, thank you very much for this meeting. And I just wanted to say I did learn some things. So always willing to listen and always willing to learn. So thank you very much.
Thank you. That concludes the informational meeting that we had prepared. Mr. Allenack, do you have any closing comments before we adjourn?
Madam Chair, I guess the one point I would add is urge the committee members to look ahead to the Monday agenda. There's an informational meeting titled Continuing Federal Connection and Tax Equity Discussions. And the intent there is for the committee to have some time to reflect and think on the Federal Connect discussions as well as this discussion, and actually continue the discussion on Monday to see what thoughts the committee members have, questions, and just moving forward on the topic.
Thank you. That concludes our agenda. We're adjourned.